This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed. and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Junior doctors in England walk out over pay and working conditions. The NHS says that industrial action is the most disruptive in its history. The U.S. and the Philippines begin their largest ever joint military drills as tensions with China mount. And more U.S. allies express concern over the leak of the highly sensitive documents in the U.S. Thanks for joining us. In the UK, tens of thousands of junior doctors have once again staged a strike over pay and working conditions, creating new headaches for the country's health services. Junior doctors, who make up around half of the National Health Service staff, are asking for a 35% pay rise. However, Health Secretary Steve Barclay says that the pay demand is unrealistic. The NHS has warned that the four-day industrial action is the most disruptive in its history and will have a catastrophic impact on its services. According to officials, up to 350,000 appointments and operations are likely to be cancelled due to the walkout. The UK has seen a wave of strikes across various public sectors since last summer, with workers demanding inflation-matching pay rises. The country's inflation hit a 40-year high of more than 11% in October. Taiwan's defense ministry says 8 Chinese warships remain in the waters around the island after Beijing concluded a 3-day military drill in the area. The ministry did not give the details on the movement of the Chinese vessels. Earlier, President Tsai Ing-wen criticized what she called Beijing's irresponsible behavior, saying the drills caused regional instability. China launched military exercises involving warships and fighter jets in reaction to a meeting between Tsai and the U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. The meeting took place during the Taiwanese president's stopover in the U.S. on her way back from Central America. China regards Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to its diplomatic and military ties with the U.S. However, the Chinese drills caused concern in neighboring Japan, with Tokyo calling them intimidating.
It was intimidating training. It is difficult to give a definitive answer regarding the intentions and objectives of the Chinese military's activities. But China said the drills are a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces. China appears to have shown an uncompromising attitude regarding the issue of Taiwan.
Also, in reaction to the Chinese drills, the Philippines and the U.S. have kicked off their largest ever war games in the South China Sea. Nearly 18,000 troops from both sides are taking part in the annual exercises, dubbed Balikatan, or Shoulder to Shoulder. On Monday, the U.S. Navy also said that its guided missile destroyers sailed through waters claimed by Beijing in the South China Sea. Beijing reacted by saying that the American warship illegally intruded into its territorial waters. The North Korean leader has called for boosting the country's war deterrence with increasing speed and in a more practical and offensive manner. Kim Jong-un made the comments at a meeting of the Central Military Commission. The meeting reportedly discussed how to counter escalating U.S. and South Korean moves to unleash a war of aggression. Pyongyang has been reacting angrily to a recent series of joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises, which it says are rehearsals for an all-out war. In response, it has been carrying out various military activities. Those include unveiling new, smaller nuclear warheads, testing a nuclear-capable underwater attack drone, and firing an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of striking anywhere in the U.S. The Pentagon says the leak of its classified files presents a very serious risk to U.S. national security. The U.S. Defense Department says the disclosures could even be deadly, putting the country's intelligence sources at risk. It voiced fear that the leaked documents could give the country's enemies valuable information. Scores of highly sensitive documents have been circulating on social media for months, but only began to receive media attention last week. The U.S. is now trying to remove them. The White House is concerned that there may be more documents to come. Many of the documents relate to the war in Ukraine, but others show that Washington has been spying on its allies, including Kiev, Tel Aviv, and Seoul. The leak of Pentagon's classified files has rattled U.S. officials as the documents show that Washington had been spying on its key allies. The leak has sparked reactions from some countries, including Australia, which has described it as a serious incident. Campbell said, however, that the U.S. is working with its allies to understand the fallout of the leak. South Korea has downplayed the issue, saying the documents contained untrue and altered information and that the files were fabricated, but the country's opposition lawmakers have expressed regret over Washington's possible spying on Seoul. The documents include information about Washington's pressure on Seoul to help supply ammunition to Ukraine. That's despite South Korea's official policy of not providing lethal weapons to countries at war. We have discussed the detail in the leaked U.S. documents and its fallout during our news review program. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Jennifer Chang out of Seoul and Gilbert Doctorow, Independent International Affairs Analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. I have Jennifer by phone. I'm going to start off in Seoul with Jennifer. Jennifer, give me the latest as far as the reaction with in dealing with all of this in South Korea. South Korea officials, obviously, being an ally of the United States, obviously should be quite upset. Tell me about what's happening over there and reaction-wise.
Well, it's a huge story here. It's a storm of controversy because the current South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, is a hardliner against North Korea. So he desperately wants a strong alliance with the U.S. And indeed, he's going to be the first South Korean president to make a state visit to the U.S. to meet President Biden in about 2 weeks, and this puts him in a terrible position. Right now, he has calls not only from his own camp, but also the opposition party, asking him to talk to the U.S. about this problem of eavesdropping by the CIA. And in fact, the opposition camp is blaming his relocation of the presidential office from Cheongwade, the Blue House, to the defense ministry right next to a U.S. military base, saying that that makes it vulnerable to eavesdropping by the CIA. And it's really a terrible situation. The South Koreans have a policy of not supplying lethal aid to countries at war. That means Ukraine. And they do not want to upset any country by sending artillery shells or ammunition, which is what the U.S. requested, over to Ukraine. So this, in remarkable detail, this document that was leaked about the CIA's eavesdropping tells about a conversation between two senior South Korean national security officials about concerns by the country's National Security Council over a U.S. request for ammunition. And the way they got around it was they thought about selling the ammunition to Poland, thinking that maybe that would camouflage their supply of weapons to Ukraine at the request of the U.S.
Okay, stay with me, Jennifer. Let me get Gilbert in on this discussion. Gilbert, what do you think about this whole situation is leaking? There are some that say that it's actually a misinformation campaign done by the U.S. itself, but others are saying that it is quite damaging. What's your overall assessment?
Well, this leak has set off alarm bells not only in Seoul. But in respect to your last question about there being genuine bona fide documents or falsified documents for other reasons than are obvious, that question has been foremost in Moscow, where among the many documents, there are several hundred pages here, among the many documents are assessments of the Ukrainian army's overall position, its supply of anti-aircraft missiles and other defense capabilities of Ukraine, which, from the Russian perspective, would appear to be lulling the Russians into a feeling of confidence that could be damaging toward their chances of military success once the Ukrainians launch their counteroffensive that's expected in the next few weeks. So this issue, are these documents genuine or not, was given a lot of attention by Russian military intelligence, and the results were discussed today on public television. The consensus is that the documents are genuine. In that sense, the authorities in Seoul have every reason to be outraged. However, the outrage that they're showing is more with respect to the Korean domestic audience. Anyone in the international arena has to be aware that going back several years, there was a disclosure vastly greater of secret documents from the United States in the Edward Snowden scandal. And so it was evident then that the United States was systematically, and we may assume is systematically, listening in to the private conversations of government leaders. The one that was most outstanding back then in the Snowden scandal was Angela Merkel, whose personal phone was being tapped by the United States.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Jennifer Chang out of Seoul joined me by phone. And Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels.
Iran's parliament speaker says escalating Israeli aggression against Palestinians is further proof of the regime's apartheid nature. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says that Israel is trying to cover up its own internal weaknesses and divisions by continuing massacre of Palestinians, as well as the storming and desecration of holy sites. Ghalibaf noted that the Iranian parliament is the sole way to counter Israel's expansionism. He added that parliaments of Muslim states must shape their government's policies on Palestine. Ghalibaf was virtually addressing the Palestine Committee of the Organization of Islamic Countries Parliamentary Union. The Iranian Army's chief commander has brushed aside the Israeli military's rhetoric, saying that the regime is too weak to be considered a threat. Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi was responding to the Israeli military chief of staff. Herzi Halevi had said that Israel is ready to attack Iran and can do so without the support of the U.S. The Iranian Army commander says such comments are aimed at boosting the morale of Israeli troops and addressing the regime's internal problems. The general warned against unwise measures by the leaders of the regime that is already on the brink of collapse. Israel has for years threatened Iran with military action over the country's nuclear program. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says that Israeli military rhetoric against Iran is merely intended for domestic purposes.
I think this is just part of the Zionist saber rattling. We've been seeing it for well over a decade now, especially under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. Iran is the big boogeyman in the region, and it's a way to use Iran and the threats, quote-unquote, that Iran poses towards the Zionist regime as a political capital for domestic consumption within Israeli society. So I do not see this as being serious. The only thing that that really supports the Zionist regime is not only the U.S., but the fact that it has nuclear weapons. If it had neither support nor nuclear weapons, it would collapse tomorrow. But of course, this is part of ongoing saber rattling. And I should mention that, of course, we've been seeing all the political upheavals within Israeli society. And so this is an opportunity to try to unite all the people around a common enemy. And that's what we're seeing now in Israel today.
The Hamas resistance movement says that Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu's threats will not weaken Palestinians' resolve to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque against the regime's religious war. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam says Netanyahu cannot intimidate the Palestinian people. He said the Israeli occupation is the source of all tensions across the occupied territories. Qassam added that Netanyahu's threats against Palestinians, as well as Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, prove that the Israeli regime is a menace to the entire region, its interests. The Hamas official stressed that the Israeli regime has been systematically and continuously practicing terrorism. During a speech on Monday, Netanyahu accused Hamas of resorting to terrorism and trying to gain a foothold in southern Lebanon. Netanyahu said Israel will, in his words, act on all fronts to stop Hamas from establishing itself in Lebanon. Saudi and Omani delegations are in Yemen to hold talks with Ansarullah officials. According to UN figures, the conflict has so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and displaced many more across the war-torn nation.
Eight years into the Saudi war on Yemen, there are hopes that the prolonged conflict may be coming to an end. Delegations from Saudi Arabia and Oman have arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to hold talks with leaders of the Ansarullah movement. Upon arrival, the delegations met with senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi. The delegations have also met with head of the council, Mahdi al-Mash'at. According to a diplomat, the Saudi delegation, headed by their ambassador to Yemen, Muhammad Said al-Jaber, is in Sana'a to discuss moving forward to create peace in Yemen. Yemeni media say the Saudis are going to negotiate the removal of tight naval and air blockade on Yemen and an end to the eight-year-long aggression, restoration of the Yemeni nation's rights, and the payment of civil servants' salaries as well as portion of oil and gas revenues during negotiations. A Yemeni source said the Saudis and Houthis had agreed in principle on a six-month truce to pave the way for talks on establishing a two-year political transition for the war-torn nation. The presence of Saudi and Omani delegations in Yemen was hailed by the Ansarullah movement. Senior Ansarullah member Muhammad al-Bukhaiti said achieving an honorable peace between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia would be a triumph for both sides. Bukhaiti has urged all sides to take steps to preserve a peaceful atmosphere and prepare to turn the page of the past. Inside Yemen, people express hope that the negotiations would produce favorable results.
We hope for the best and we hope that these negotiations can lead the people to safety.
The talks also drew positive reactions from the United Nations. UN Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, described the ongoing efforts, including the Saudi and Omani talks in Sana'a, as the closest Yemen has been to real progress towards lasting peace since the war began. He said this is a moment to be seized and built on, and a real opportunity to start an inclusive political process under UN auspices to sustainably end the conflict.
An expanding wildfire has triggered evacuations in South Korea's eastern coastal city of Gwangmyeong. Firefighters are struggling to control the blaze that started on Monday and are being fanned by strong winds and dry weather conditions. Gwangmyeong has a population of more than 200,000. There was no immediate reports of casualties. Around 300 residents have so far been evacuated. Photos and footage circulating on social media show large plumes of smokes and fires raising across forests and fields. President Yoon Suk-yeol has ordered officials to mobilize all available resources to put out the blaze and to evacuate nearby residents to minimize casualties. And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, with the previous episode, we finished the memoirs of Imam Khomeini's wife on this unmatched leader of the modern history. In the new part of this series, we are going to dwell upon the views of the world thinkers and scholars on Imam Khomeini and his historical revolution. Stay tuned, please. During the 1960s and 1970s, the tyrannical regime of the Iranian Shah was in its best condition from the viewpoints of power parameters, both internally and externally. Yet, those very years were the time of the start of popular protest, which very soon turned into a nationwide revolution led by Imam Khomeini. The flare-up of such a historical revolution was so incredible in Iran that the U.S. president in those years, Jimmy Carter, had called Iran the island of stability in the volatile West Asian region. Of course, the analysts who observed Iran's socio-political developments during and after the 1953 British-U.S. coup and toppling of Mohammad Mossadegh's legal government were apparently right on the Shah's absolute power. Although the political and economic corruption which had caused sort of concern for the Pahlavi regime's survival among the Western countries in 1950s, the power indexes of the regime in 1960s indicated its stability inside the country and abroad. In 1960s, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi started so-called reforms under the name of White Revolution, which was in fact a broad move to suffocate his political opponents. Thus, he expelled all political groups, whether left or right, from the scene and became the sole dominant authority all over the country. Moreover, during the early 1970s, the regime garnered exorbitant revenues thanks to the global rise in the oil prices and fortified the shaky economy. The ample petrodollars also helped the Shah to purchase modern military and spying equipment from the West to promote security and intelligence ability of the military and security forces. As a result, the notorious Savak Security Organization benefited from the experiences of the criminal Israeli espionage apparatus Mossad to suppress any opposing group or person in the country. Then the Shah got the role of the regional gendarme thanks to his good relations with the U.S. under Richard Nixon. In spite of the Pahlavi regime's heyday in early 1970s, the Iranian nation staged their unmatched revolution under the leadership of Imam Khomeini and through the royal tyranny in the dustbin of history for good. Many Western thinkers and observers were perplexed with the Iranian nation's movement as they couldn't understand their ideal and goal of the revolution. French thinker Michel Foucault was one of the thinkers who had traveled to Iran in the heat of the revolution. Foucault was the professor of Clermont University in France. He traveled to Iran to observe the Islamic Revolution closely and understand its novel ideology and trend-setting features. These features were later on focused and studied by postmodernist thinkers such as Jacques Derrida, Edward Said, and Jean-François Lyotard. Many of these thinkers spoke of the Islamic Revolution as a phenomenon which couldn't be analyzed easily as it matched no other movement in the past decades or even centuries. They maintained that the Islamic Revolution couldn't be explained with the conventional theories taught at universities and research centers. These analysts concluded that the Islamic Revolution was the crystallization of the fourth phase of power. In other words, it is kind of power which gushes forth from below rather than above. According to Derrida, it is manifested in the form of posters, placards, and slogans. Foucault believed that power is an element wielded from below, and it spreads in every social aspect and will show itself in due time. He maintained that the Iranian Shah had managed to omit all opposing forces and the international powers were not considered as serious dangers for him, yet the popular power was organized and mobilized in a short time. Foucault was of the opinion that the people's prevalent power had been distributed in each and every element of society, and it had turned into a layer which shook the basis of the Shah regime and ultimately overthrew it. The French thinker believed that power shouldn't be pursued among intellectuals and political parties because they had little role, if any, in the mobilization of masses. Rather, it was the popular masses which drew in the intellectuals behind, and they were the pioneers. Another feature of the Islamic Revolution, which distinguishes it from other movements and draws the attention of the Western thinkers, is the variety of the strata supporting and participating in the revolution. The Islamic Revolution did not rely on a specific social class or stratum. Even the ulema who played the role of the leaders of the people didn't belong to a specific social or economic class. The French thinker Foucault had realized it well that the Shia clergymen are not like those of Christianity who play the role of bosses rather than spiritual leaders and fathers. The Islamic Revolution proved that the era of religion has not ended, and religion is a very important and a strong factor in every aspect of the modern world.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified. Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Rallies will take place all over the world later this month to mark International Al-Quds Day to celebrate Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. Here in the UK, a march will descend on Downing Street on the 16th of April, led by a coalition of all faiths and none united in their opposition to apartheid. We'll be discussing the impact and growing popularity of Quds Day after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra about the unsuccessful efforts of the Zionist lobby and other assorted racists to disrupt and close it down.
Quds Day is celebrated all over the world after being inaugurated by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in 1979. It is a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people, named with the Arabic word for Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine. The Zionist entity heightens its attempts to suppress Quds Day after the Gaza massacre between 27th of December 2008 and 18th of January 2009. The entity unleashed terror on Gaza, killing around 1,500 Palestinians. By contrast, 13 settlers died, and four of them were mistakenly killed by their own side. The worldwide revulsion against the massacre led to a significant rise in support for the Palestinians and worldwide protests. As a result, Israel's assets increased their attempts to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. Over time, the Quds Day March would become a key focus of that activity. For example, in the UK, for 27 years, the annual Al-Quds Day demonstration concluded with a rally in the iconic Trafalgar Square, in the heart of Whitehall and just yards from Downing Street, the residence of the British Prime Minister. Protests against Quds Day in the UK had started in 2007, organised by the Islamophobic pro-Zionist blog Harry's Place. By 2009, for the first time, the organisers were denied the use of Trafalgar Square, following threats from Islamophobic groups. The march was also attended by a counter-demonstration, in which Iranian supporters of the deposed Shah of Iran, the far right, and of course Zionists, made common cause. Since then, the pressure over Quds Day in the UK has only mounted. In 2016, there were complaints about the presence of Hezbollah flags from the far right and Zionists. In 2017, the Zionist Federation and a shopping list of Zionist groups organized a counter-demonstration. Later, activists made complaints about one of the speakers, Nazem Ali, a pharmacist, and attempted to have him sacked from his job by using false allegations of anti-Semitism to complain to his regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council. The council concluded his words were not anti-Semitic, but the Zionists, in the shape of UK Lawyers for Israel, and Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, both of which are closely linked to the Zionist entity, continued to harass Ali. The case is still, years later, to be finally decided. It leaves the way open for Zionist groups to harass and intimidate anyone that speaks out on Palestine, even to the extent of tying them up in legal procedures for years and potentially losing their reputation, jobs and livelihoods. The Islamic Human Rights Commission has, though, continued to act as organiser and champion of Quds Day in the UK. This year, it will happen on Saturday 16th in central London, under the banner of United Against Apartheid.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is Masoud Sijara. Masoud is a long-standing human rights campaigner, and he's currently the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud helped to establish the IHRC back in 1997. Welcome to the show. David, the Zionist movement's been targeting Quds Day celebrations for nearly two decades now, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you saw in the film there a shot from an Israeli paper showing some people who were at that demonstration. 2007, I think, was the first one. Interestingly, it was organised by Harry's Place, which, as viewers may or may not know, is an Islamophobic and Zionist hate blog, and has been in operation since just shortly after 9/11, back in 2002 or so. And it's spent all of its career attacking people on the left, Muslims and others who support the Palestinians, and accusing them of extremism or supporting terrorism or anti-Semitism, all the usual kind of slurs which the right throws at the left and at politically active Muslims. So it's an interesting tale there. And what's also interesting, I thought, was in that photograph on the demonstration, you saw Peter Tatchell, a younger Peter Tatchell, with a placard condemning the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so you see in that demonstration back in 2007 the kind of coalescence between supporters effectively of the Shah of Iran, the far right, and Zionists all together in an alliance which has only become more obvious and stronger over time. But very interesting, it goes back as far as that.
Mm, indeed, very interesting. And certainly Peter Tatchell's involvement there, he has some curious positions on a range of different topics, doesn't he? Indeed. But anyway, Masoud, I mean, the IHRC's been organising the UK Quds Day demonstrations now for many years. I mean, how did your involvement start, and how's this developed? How's it developed over the years?
Well, I've personally been involved in organising and helping to organise Al-Quds Day even prior to establishment of IHRC. The fact of the matter is that Al-Quds Day is significant because it was the first international day of solidarity with Palestinians. Mm. Long before the sort of Nakba Day and so forth being established. And it was a Muslim platform to be shared with everyone else to stand up in solidarity with the Palestinian, and really brought a huge change within the Muslim world in rallying support for the Palestinians, and it continues now, and that's why it's being targeted day in, day out. That's why the sort of unholy marriages between the extreme right and the sort of racist and Zionists and everybody else, it really is a testimony to the sort of diversity of the group of people that come together from the Jewish, from the Christian, from the atheists, you know, really people coming together.
David, I wonder if we could just turn now to the case against Nazim Ali. I mean, it's dragged on and on and on, hasn't it? I mean, is that unusual?
It's quite unusual, but it's part of the modus operandi of the Zionists, isn't it? They try and, in many other cases too, try and tie people up in a case, and then when they lose that case, they go on to take another action, and then another action, and another action. This case has been before his professional body. It's been before the supervisory body of the professional body. It's been before the High Court. It's been sent back to the supervisory body in the first place, and we still haven't got any kind of resolution of it. It's been going dragging on for years and years. But you know, not unusual in the sense that that's what the Zionists try and do. They try and gummy you up in procedure, so that you spend, you know, like, literally a significant proportion of your life fighting something which should never have been an issue in the first place.
No, indeed. I mean, and Masood, I wonder whether you could tell us a bit more about the case of Nazim Ali, because obviously it's still ongoing, isn't it?
Well, David is absolutely right. I mean, the tactic is to sort of damage individuals to the extent that nobody else will support the Palestinian cause, and to silence anyone who will stand and support the genuine need of the Palestinian. Now, what they did regarding Nazim, first of all, they target the police. Number of times for them to prosecute, they refuse on every level. 3 or 4 intervention and they failed. Then they targeted the public prosecutors several times. They refused to take part. Then they took the matter into civil court, and then public prosecutors got in and stopped it. So then they took it to the professional body, and then they lost. I mean, every stage they have actually lost, but they have persisted using any means to pressurize and demonize and create a precedent so no one else will dare to challenge them. Now, what has happened now, the last stage, is that they argued that the way that the professional body dealt with it, it was unacceptable because they actually they took it into area of intention and so forth. They're saying that should not be taken into account. It should not be taken into account in the decision-making. So it's gone back. But in the same time, when they are dealing with their own supporters, we had a case in Scotland, a teacher acted and that is anti-Semite and starts sending anti-Semite material out on public arena. Then he was found and then was taken into court. They argued, the same people are saying that the intention and so forth should not be taken into account. They argued that the intention has to be taken into account. So they are really just making a mockery of any principle. Yeah. The only principle they are upholding is that no one should defend Palestinians or attack Israelis. To do so is anti-Semite, and it needs to be fought on every level. That is the only principle. In their eyes, there is no good pro-Palestinian. No.
David, would it be fair to say that there's a variety of groups that are trying to suppress Quds Day?
Certainly. I mean, of course, first of all, there's the alliance between the far-right, pro-Shah of Iran supporters, and the Zionists. But within the Zionist movement, there are literally tens of different Zionist organizations. You saw in the video there a whole list of Zionist organizations, almost all of which have got direct connections to the Israeli government itself, and most importantly in terms of the organisations there, UK Lawyers for Israel and the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, both of which, direct connections to the State of Israel. The UK LFI was effectively set up by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the CAA funded to a large extent by the
Campaign Against Anti-Semitism,
by the Jewish National Fund, which of course is the main land-grabbing agency in occupied Palestine. So, very, very wide range of organisations.
Well, we're just going to pause there for a moment because we've got another report now on the efforts being made to suppress Quds Day because of its growing success.
Quds Day is a global celebration of the Palestinian resistance and the ardent desire of the mass of the world's population for the full liberation of Palestine. It was inaugurated by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini shortly after the Islamic Revolution as a response to Jerusalem Day, in which Jewish settlers rampage around Al-Quds, which they call Jerusalem, chanting racist slogans including, "May your village burn." In 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "For many years I've been notifying the Muslims of the danger posed by the usurper Israel. I ask all the Muslims of the world and the Muslim governments to join together to sever the hand of this usurper and its supporters," and through a ceremony demonstrating the solidarity of Muslims worldwide, announced their support for the legitimate rights of the Muslim people. The day is also marked throughout Muslim and Arab countries, in over 80 Islamic and non-Islamic countries in total. In the West, these include the United States of America, Canada, Australia, Germany, Spain, the United Kingdom, France, and Greece. As a result, the Muslim unity displayed in Quds Day is a threat to the Zionist entity and its supporters and assets in the West and elsewhere. Accordingly, they mobilized to smear and denounce Quds Day and to claim that its celebration exhibits extremism and anti-Semitism. In the UK, Zionist groups have been attempting to sabotage the celebration for more than 15 years. In the US, Zionist entity assets have gone on the offensive. The Anti-Defamation League, which is an extension of the Zionist regime's intelligence apparatus in the US, denounced Quds Day in 2016 as, quote, a hateful demonstration of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment. In 2022, it labeled calls for the dismantling of Zionism, quite fancifully, as genocidal ambitions. In Germany, Bundesamt für Verfassungsschutz, or Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution in English, is the domestic intelligence agency. In 2019, it published a deeply racist report on anti-Semitism and Islamist extremism. It specifically singled out Quds Day and denounced a huge range of Muslim political groups as extreme. All were labeled with the Zionist-created notion of Islamic anti-Semitism. The report openly states that German intelligence spies on peaceful and legal Muslim activists, so long as they are defined as Islamist, a racist term which effectively covers any Muslim active in politics. The temporary Zionist entity continues its onslaught of ethnic cleansing and murder. But this year, the celebration of Quds Day go ahead, and in a situation more advantageous for the Palestinians than in many years.
David, do you think you can compare Quds Day with Jerusalem Day?
Well, you can compare them, and it's not a very nice comparison. I mean, Quds Day is about suggesting that we liberate Palestine, that we end the occupation by the Zionists. And for Jerusalem Day, it's a celebration of racist hate. I mean, the death to the Arabs, which is routinely heard, mayor, village burn, a second Nakba is coming. This is a vile racism on this naked display in the streets of Jerusalem. Whereas in Quds Day, what we see is the possibility of the ending of the occupation, of the ending of this kind of racism. So, yes, of course, you can compare them, but it's not a very good comparison.
Chalk and cheese, really, then. Yeah, I mean, Masood, what would you say is the worldwide significance of Quds Day? I mean, do you think it helps to bridge the divide in the Muslim world?
Well, it does. I mean, it has mobilised the masses in the Muslim world when we have seen, unfortunately, some Muslim leaders are involved in normalisation. But indeed, the masses have been involved and has been mobilized. And we saw in World Cup how masses of Muslims are so committed. That is part of this ongoing awareness of what's going on. And in the non-Muslim world, the way that Muslim, Jews, Christians, atheists, everyone has come together, it actually is a credit, to everyone. And it's something that needs to be celebrated. And I actually think that, last year on Al-Quds Day, Professor Haim said something very fundamental. He said he's an atheist. He's completely believes in atheism. But what he has studied in history, the only time that Muslims, Christians, and Jews have managed to live together has been under Muslim rule. And I think that's a factual thing. Sure. Yeah. And he was actually praising that the Muslims are committed to this. Yes. And I think what we are doing, what we're coming together to articulate that.
Yes.
We want to end of apartheid, we want end of occupation, because we want to live together.
Yeah, yes, indeed. The World Cup was really inspirational. I mean, although Palestine wasn't sort of competing in the World Cup finals, they were the big winners, it seems to me, and everybody seemed united right across the piece in support for Palestine. It was fantastic. But David, the video we've mentioned, a German intelligence report, didn't it? And it seemed pretty extraordinary to me, I've got to say. I mean, To what extent do you think it expresses Zionist assumptions?
Well, it very much expresses Zionist assumptions. Even the idea of Islamism, sure, is something which, a term which is originated by Zionist ideologues in the 1980s, after 1979, after the Islamic Revolution.
Indeed.
And also the idea of Islamic anti-Semitism, a concept which wasn't known in the world 30 years ago, so it's been invented again by the Zionists. And here we see, effectively, it could have been written by an Israel lobby group, but it's actually written by the German internal intelligence organization. So, again, another instance where Zionist assumptions have totally penetrated the country of Germany through internal intelligence system. Just like that has been the case in a number of other Western countries. But we've seen in the show before the particular role that Germany has played in supporting Zionism as a result of its misplaced guilt for the Second World War, thinking that what they've got to do is to support Israel as opposed to the guilt that they have for the assault on the Jews. These are Zionist assumptions which need to be removed, because otherwise we're never going to have the possibility of a proper support for democracy in Palestine.
Yes, indeed. Support Jewish people by pressing the Palestinians doesn't sound like a fair deal to me at all. But Masoud, I mean, you chair the Islamic Human Rights Commission, as I was saying in the introduction there, and you've been consistently targeted, haven't you, by Zionists over the years. I mean, tell us a bit about that. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
It's a badge of honour, really. I remember in my youth being targeted by the apartheid South Africa. It was a badge of honour.
Yes.
It is a badge of honour now to be targeted. And actually, I think we need to give the confidence to our community that if you're not being targeted by the last apartheid system in the world, then there is something wrong. You can't be a human rights activist and activist for a better world if you're not targeted.
Yeah.
But the problem is this, that they're systematically doing it, as they've done it to David, as they've done it to Nazim, as they've done it to Reverend Sizer, as they've done it to Jeremy. I mean, Jeremy hasn't got an ounce of racism in him. We all know him.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been victimised by them too.
Well, exactly. But I think we all should worry with the badge of honour. Actually, I think we need to sort of say that those who haven't been targeted, who are claiming to speak for justice and inclusive society, then they have to explain why.
Sure, yeah. David, just remind us, will you, about the Anti-Defamation League and its relationship with the FBI and Mossad.
So the Anti-Defamation League has been in existence for over a century now, and it was set up to contest the defamation of the Jewish people. But from very early on, within a couple of decades of its creation, it started to spy on Arab Americans, people who were involved in the campaign to prevent the creation of the State of Israel. And from 1948 onwards, it intensified its spying, very closely working with the FBI, spying on Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, and Arab Americans. And, of course, in 1993, the big scandal erupted where it was shown that it had been passing a spy information that it gleaned from its spying operations, closely working with the FBI, onto BOS, the South African Apartheid Intelligence Organization, including passing them information for money. So there's a really very long relationship between the ADL and spy agencies. And, of course, in fact, what it's been doing as part of this process has been operating as a kind of wing of the Israeli intelligence apparatus in the US.
And just finally, and briefly, because we're almost out of time, Masoud, I mean, why you think they should join the Quds demonstration in London on April the 16th?
I think we should join it basically because we support a just cause. Yeah. And that just cause needs to have champions. And we need to rise up to that challenge. But we should also stand and realize that it is effective. The reason that the Zionists are putting so much effort in trying to stop it is because it's effective and it will bring confidence to all of us to stand together, because standing together is more important.
Unity is strength. Come and help spike the guns of the Zionist lobby, I think is Masoud's message. I'm afraid That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to our guests, Masood Sijara, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Make a date in your diary to tune into next week's episode of Palestine Declassified, when we'll be back with more investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of this series. Allah says in Ayah 59 of Surah Nisa, O you who have faith, obey Allah and obey the Apostle and those vested with authority among you. According to this ayah, Muslims are obligated to obey Allah, His Prophet, and those who are vested with authority. Allah and the Prophet are clear. But who are those vested with authority? As per the exegetes of the Quran, these are the 12 imams of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, who are infallible, just like the Prophet himself. Of course, the exegetes of the Quran explicate this holy book on the basis of hadith.